Sehr gut, sehr gut, sehr gut.
Sehr gut?
Wieso Steuer ist sehr gut? Das sagen ganz viele.
Cool, wer sagt das?
Stiftung Warentest, Computerbild, Focus Money, Chip, Finanztipp, such dir was aus.
Mega, aber das ist doch bestimmt kompliziert.
Nö, einfach Foto von der Lohnsteuerbescheinigung machen und fertig.
Klingt sehr gut.
Ist sehr gut. Hol dir dein Geld zurück mit Wieso Steuer.
Stu does America.
Follow the show on YouTube, youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Subscribe, do all the things. Chris Bedford is here with the latest on the potential government shutdown. Jimmy Kimmel, he's had that big burst in ratings. It seems to be fading a little bit. We'll look at the latest there. But we're going to start by doing an end to the Israel-Hamas war. Is it possible? Are we there? Donald Trump wants to make this happen, and he's investing a lot of capital in trying to make it so. He has a 20-point proposal for peace in the Gaza Strip, ending the Israel-Hamas war. And what's interesting about this is, and first of all, I really like this tactic by Donald Trump. I like the strategy here. You know, a lot of Trump's inherent, like, tactics, the classic tactics that we associate with Donald Trump work really well in a scenario just like this, because he's able to refocus people on, I think, what's really important here. You can, you know, now it's like he's come out, he's made this big announcement. He's basically announced peace in the Middle East as long as Hamas comes along. He and Israel are aligned. It's done. We're all set. We just need Hamas. That's all we need. And he's now positioned this in a way that make it, you know, appropriately look at, for all of us to look at Hamas and say, well, we're waiting. Go ahead. Let's see if you'll come along to end this war. There's no really real reason for Hamas to have hostages. Now, I understand they don't have any real leverage after these hostages are returned, but that should actually be the appropriate thing here. They should not have any hostages, and we should be down a long road for them to be out of power in this particular community. And that's happened with a lot of them, because a lot of them are no longer, you know, alive, because they've been decimated by the Israelis. But there's a 20-step process. We're not going to go through all 20, obviously, but let me give you some of the highlights here. Number one, Gaza will be a de-radicalized, terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbors. Who would have thought it was possible? I don't know if it is possible, honestly, but seems like a pretty easy thing to admit up front if you're going to end a war. Now, what's happened over and over again is there have been a lot of ceasefires proposed and agreed to, and no one ever bothers to ask Gaza if they want to go along with it. No one ever bothers to ask Hamas if they would like a ceasefire, because that means they stop firing too. They don't ever seem to want that. In fact, they have very clear desires for this region, and they want war to continue to go on, because the longer it goes on, the longer they can claim that they're the victims, and the longer that the world turns on Israel. That's what they, of course, want. That was the desire when they went in on October 7th. Yes, it was, of course, to murder and rape and do all these terrible things to Israeli citizens, but they never had the idea they were going to win a military war by doing that. This was not an idea to go in there and say, hey, we're going to take over Israel. We're going to come up with our own buffer zone to keep Israel out. That was never even a thought or a prayer. What it was to create enough terror and anger in the Israeli population that they would righteously strike back. And then after a period of time, they knew the people of the world would turn on Israel, because, you know, that's happened every single time. So that's where we are. Step number two for Trump, Gaza will be redeveloped for the benefit of the people of Gaza, who have suffered more than enough. I don't know if this means we're getting Trump Gaza hotels and casinos. I don't know if this means we're getting the roller coasters, the Starbucks, the Cinnabons. I don't know. Maybe that's what that means. A little bit undefined there. Step three, if both sides agree to this proposal, the war will immediately end. Israeli forces will withdraw to the agreed upon line to prepare for a hostage release. During this time, all military operations, including aerial and artillery bombardment, will be suspended, and battle lines will remain frozen until conditions are met for complete staged withdrawal. So, big thing they're giving up there, right? They're no longer bombing. They're no longer doing anything in Gaza. They're stopping all military actions. Obviously, a big give for Israel in this particular situation. I leave that there. Remember that, and let's just say, within 72 hours of Israel publicly accepting this agreement, all hostages, alive and deceased, will be returned. Very basic ask. Hey, you know, stop stealing our people. Once all hostages are released, this is step five, Israel will release 250 life sentence prisoners plus 1,700 Gazans who were detained after October 7th, including all women and children detained in that context. For every Israeli hostage whose remains are released, Israel released the remains of 15 deceased Gazans. Again, this is not, you know, tit for tat. Okay, it's tit for lots of tats. That's the way this works. Whenever Israel goes through one of these situations, you have a situation where it's, you know, 1 for 15, 1 for 20, 1 for 30, 1 for 40. It's always much, much more given back to the Gazans than the Israelis ever get. Once all hostages are returned, Hamas members who commit to peaceful coexistence and to decommission their weapons will be given amnesty. Members of Hamas who wish to leave Gaza will be provided safe passage to receiving countries. So there, again, this is a massive give for Israel. I know a lot of people who are hawkish on Israel, who are defenders of Israel, who do not like this at all. The idea that people who are in Hamas, who maybe were involved in at least knowledge of some of these situations, could say, hey, I'm not going to be in Hamas anymore. I'm going to stay. Or I'm just going to leave and go to another country. And Israel is going to help them with passage. That's way above and beyond what they've typically offered. Skipping to step 11, a special economic zone will be established with preferred tariff and access rates to begin negotiated with participating countries. I would just ask, please don't give Gaza lower tariff rates than a lot of our allies. I mean, of all things, I beg of you that. Number 12, no one will be forced to leave Gaza, and those who wish to leave will be free to do so and free to return. We will encourage people to stay and offer them the opportunity to build a better Gaza. Step 14, a guarantee will be provided by regional partners to ensure that Hamas and the factions comply with their new obligations and that new Gaza poses no threat to its neighbors or its people. Now, of course, exposing no threat is a must, right? It's going to be difficult. But how is that going to happen? Well, not Israel doing it. Regional partners are going to do it. That's another massive give by Israel. This is their country. Gaza's part of Israel. I don't know if anyone knows that. It's part of Israel. They can go in there however they want to go in there if they choose to. What they're saying is we're going to invite countries that used to be attacking them as part of a coalition from around the area to come in and work on making Gaza a better, more sane place. So not only a good sign, it would be a good thing certainly for Gaza and certainly for Israel generally, but also a really good sign for Israel that they're able to work with partners in the region like this. The United States will work with Arab and international partners to develop a temporary international stabilization force, ISF, to immediately deploy to Gaza. The ISF will train and provide support to vetted Palestinian police forces in Gaza and will consult with Jordan and Egypt to have extensive experience in this field. This force will be the long-term internal security solution. That's a big thing as well. The ISF will work with Israel and Egypt to help secure border areas along with newly trained Palestinian police forces. It is critical to prevent munitions from entering Gaza and to facilitate the rapid and secure flow of goods to rebuild and revitalize Gaza. A de-confliction mechanism will be agreed upon by the parties. So this outside group with countries like Egypt come in, they'll manage the situation. Now, again, it's not quite clear if they've agreed to this yet, but they would get involved. Israel says that's okay. They've already agreed to this. Kind of a big deal. And remember how this comes down. Trump and Netanyahu say, yeah, we're in. So now it's up to Hamas whether they agree to this or not. A couple more here. Step 16, Israel will not occupy or annex Gaza. Another big give for Israel. And the ISF establishes control and stability. The IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, will withdraw based on standards, milestones, and timeframes linked to demilitarization that will be agreed upon between the IDF, ISF, and the guarantors, the United States, with the objective of a secure Gaza that no longer opposes a threat to Israel, Egypt, or its citizens. Practically, the IDF will progressively hand over the Gaza territory it occupies to the ISF according to an agreement that they will make with the transitional authority. They are withdrawn completely from Gaza, save for security perimeter presence that will remain until Gaza is properly secure from any resurgent terror threat. You realize what a big deal this is for Israel to give up, right? This is a lot. They're saying, hey, we're going to assign a chunk of our country to Egypt, who pretty recently wanted us dead, and a bunch of other countries from the region who don't like us all that much as well. Trump ends it with step 20. The United States will establish a dialogue between Israel and the Palestinians to agree upon a political horizon for peaceful and prosperous coexistence. There's some messages, mentions of potentially a path to statehood, though nothing guaranteed in there. But that's a lot. This is a lot of stuff that certainly hardline Israelis and Israeli defenders do not want any them going anywhere near any of this stuff. So how does the New York Times analyze it? You're going to be surprised to hear, with new U.S. proposal to end Gaza war, a rare moment of triumph for Netanyahu. Here's how they explain it, though. Ultimately, Mr. Netanyahu got almost everything he could have hoped for Mr. Trump's proposal. A demand that Hamas release the hostages immediately and lay down its weapons. I mean, that's got to be the basis of this, right? That's not just something Netanyahu is asking for. You got to release the hostages. He says, without which Israel would have carte blanche to keep pummeling Gaza. So they're basically saying the Jews are lying. That's the New York Times' first analysis. Then they go to this. As for Israeli troops, they would get to remain in Gaza's perimeter for the foreseeable future. They would get to. It's their own freaking country. There was such a stinting nod to the aspiration of statehood for Palestinians that the proposal all but suggested they just keep dreaming. And the Palestinian Authority would be kept left playing no role in Gaza anytime soon. So, of course, the New York Times taking the most negative possible on this. Hamas is leaning toward, by the way, accepting Trump's Gaza ceasefire plan quickly, source tells CBS News. Now, look, got to take this with a grain of salt. It's information that's coming from Hamas. So who knows what they will actually do. But the idea that they're actually considering this and leaning maybe yes is pretty interesting. A diplomatic source with knowledge of the talks told CBS News that the Egyptian official and the Qatari prime minister have provided Hamas representative with a copy of the proposal. The Palestinian Authority, which partially administers areas of the West Bank, that's, of course, Israeli-occupied West Bank, as they call it, issued a statement supporting the plan, which was published by the PA-linked Wafa news agency, one of my favorites. I've got it linked, a big follower of the Wafa news agency. In its statement, the PA stressed the importance of the partnership with the United States in achieving peace in the region and reaffirmed its commitments to certain reforms. Now, it's the Palestinian Authority. Who knows what that means for Hamas exactly, but they're indicating maybe they're interested. Now, it's also important to realize this Hamas is not the Hamas. The Hamas, most of those people are dead. They killed a bunch of them with pagers. I don't know if you remember that. They've killed a bunch of them through warfare. They've killed a bunch of them over and over and over and over again. Well, it was Hezbollah as well. But you get the point here. Bottom line is they've been able to decimate these organizations. So now you're talking like third or fourth string Hamas people out there in the conversations. Maybe they're going to be a little more open to ending the suffering of their people. Because the people who led Hamas previously didn't care about that at all. So you couldn't win them over by saying, hey, we'll make the lives of your citizens better, because they didn't care about the lives of their citizens. What they want is their own citizens to die to prove a point and to get people to hate Jews, which, by the way, has worked. You're rewarding them for that behavior. Congratulations on that. Now, this all happens, and this is why I think it was such a brilliant move by Donald Trump. And I think he's done some really good things when it comes to foreign affairs in particular. He set this up in a position where the American people and people around the world are turning against Israel. We've seen multiple countries come out and say we're recognizing Palestinian statehood, which is just a joke. It doesn't really mean anything, but it is a statement. Americans, you've seen this on campuses, you've seen numbers rising in the amount of people who are agreeing with the Palestinians or the Hamas members over Jews in Israel. And now we get this. American support for Israel dramatically declines, according to a Times Siena poll. In the aftermath of the Hamas-led attacks on Israel on October 7th, American voters broadly sympathized with Israelis over Palestinians, with 47% siding with Israel and 20% with Palestinians, which is actually an incredibly low number. Like, they just came across the border and murdered 1,500 people, and you're like, we're about split. 47% sounds about right for support. I mean, that's just insane in and of itself, but only 20% siding with the Palestinians. In the new poll, it's basically split. 34% said they sided with Israel, 35% with the Palestinians, 31% said they were unsure or backed both equally. One of the reasons for this is people now believe that the Israelis are just massacring innocent people for no reason. And honestly, American people are good people. They tend to see something like that and think, this sounds really, really bad. Maybe we should stop supporting them. Now, a lot of this, of course, isn't true, but that doesn't really matter. Do you think Israel is intentionally or unintentionally killing civilians? That has risen from intentionally from 22 to 40%. Unintentionally has dropped from 21 to 16, and Israel is taking enough precautions to avoid civilian casualties. Started out in first place 30%, now dropped to 25%, 15% behind people believe that they're intentionally killing civilians. And I got to be honest here, it's sort of ridiculous. They take a lot of precautions in this realm to not kill civilians. Obviously, some civilians have died. It's a war. It's a war. Now I can tell you they haven't gone hand to hand and raped the children of Hamas, which would, I guess, be equal response. They haven't done that, which is nice of them. There have been deaths, though, however, and of course that's true. The idea that they're intentionally doing this, at least certainly in most cases, has been disproven over and over and over again. This comes back to, why do you care? Right? Like, do you care that Israel is not liked by younger generations? Do you care that Israel is not winning the PR battle? I mean, why does Trump care? Why does anybody care? Well, one person who really cared deeply about this exact issue was Charlie Kirk. This is one of the central things he got up in the morning to do. And that's not me saying, that's him saying that. He said that to, I know, Glenn. He said that to many of his friends who are kind of in more on the side of pro-Israel. He said that over and over and over again behind the scenes. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of connections with his organization and know a lot of people there. I wasn't super close with Charlie directly, but I know I am close with a lot of people who were close with him, and they've all told me very similar things about Charlie. And we now have a letter he wrote to Benjamin Netanyahu explaining his beliefs on Israel. Charlie Kirk wrote of his deep love for Israel in a letter to Netanyahu about how to counter the rising opposition to the Jewish state in the U.S. This is how he began this letter. And again, I know there's questions about how Charlie Kirk felt about Israel. I don't really understand why that is. I don't want to get into all the back and forth on it. This is one of those issues that's very well settled in my life because, you know, I've heard him talk about it directly. I've heard him talk about it through other people off the air. I heard him directly on the air talk about this. I've seen it in videos over and over again talking about how he felt about Israel. And he states it this way in a direct letter to Netanyahu. Dear Mr. Prime Minister, one of my greatest joys as a Christian is advocating for Israel and forming alliances with Jews in the fight to protect Judeo-Christian civilization. Most recently, I'm proud to have taken over Ambassador Huckabee's show on TBN, where we continually support Israel and the Jewish people. As Mohammedism spreads into Western societies, it is critical that Jews and Christians stay united in the effort to contain and roll back radical Islam and Sharia law. I regret to report that anti-Israel and anti-Semitic trends are at record levels on social media. These negative sentiments then flow downstream into college campuses and even seep into the conservative MAGA community. Now, this is a 5 or 6 page letter. I can't give you all of it. The basic tone of it is, hey, guys, like, can you fight back a little bit online? Can you not just leave this to people who support Israel? And he mentions himself as someone who goes out there and fights day to day to try to defend Israel. He says, I'm often asked, why is Israel killing so many innocent civilians in Gaza? I know Israel goes to great lengths by dropping flyers and even calling civilians to clear out areas about to be bombed. I know Israel posts maps showing which areas should be evacuated. I know that Hamas uses civilians as human shields. But 90% of younger generations get their news from social media and podcasts, and there is very little pushback or fact-checking by the Israeli government and or pro-Israel supporters in the media, especially social media. I strongly suggest Israel not always depend on subcontracting their information war efforts to surrogates in America. This is all written, by the way, a couple of months before his death. Mr. Prime Minister, I urge you to revamp your information warfare strategy from top to bottom. And then he goes through a constructive criticism list of things that he believes Israel should do. You should have a rapid response media team. I strongly recommend putting together a team of pro-Israel experts who can fact-check misinformation in real time. You need something like an Israel Truth Network, ITN, which can include social media channels and a one-stop source of information website where, for example, all the negative Israel questions I get can be thoroughly debunked. Have you considered inviting some of the released hostages to go on a speaking tour in the U.S. Maybe interview regular Israelis on the streets, ask them what they love about their country, interview Jews and Israeli Arabs. Iran, Israel could do a better job explaining the Iranian threat. A paradigm shift is needed to how Israel presents itself in the world, especially on social media. It's page after page after page of advice on this. And I want to give you one more thing here. This is towards the end. Again, this is, if you know Charlie Kirk, if you've seen him on social media, you probably don't have any doubts about how he felt about Israel. But I know there are people who have questions about it. So I'll bring this to you. You know, if you don't agree with it, you don't agree with it. Not all that concerned whether you agree with it or not, but it is pretty clear as to how he felt. In my opinion, he said, you are losing the information war, which will eventually translate into less political and military support from America. The Holy Land is so important to my life, and it pains me to see support for Israel slip away. This is almost right before he died, a couple of months before he died. More recently than that, the literal night before his death, he was on a Zoom call with people like Josh Hammer talking about how to fight back on his upcoming campus tour, which, of course, ended his life. But on his upcoming campus tour, to just explain, hey, when people ask me these questions about Israel, what's the best defense? Let's go back and forth. Let's play this out. He was very well prepared and very interested in pushing back against the negative stereotypes against Israel. I mean, you look at his social media clips over the years, you see him constantly getting in. And he was a very calm guy. Most of these interactions were very calm. But like the most angry I've ever seen him in my entire life was him going up against some guy who was kind of doing this, I don't know what you want to call it, anti-Semitic, white supremacist type of situation, which is why it makes me so angry when people like Coates and Kendi and all these people come out and say, oh, gosh, he was a white supremacist. Joy Reid come out and say this. It's so untrue. He was angry at white supremacists. He was fighting back against them at his rallies. It's just incredibly furious, frustrating. But, you know, this is what happens, I guess, after he's no longer here to defend himself. Charlie did have some issues with Israel. He outlined them in the letter quite eloquently. He was concerned that they were not pushing back against the narratives that are out there. And frankly, that's a concern that we've had here as well. We've talked to, you know, we sent Jason Buttrell, Dan Andros went to Israel years ago, and that was one of their big complaints. Like, hey, you know, when you have these videos, give them to us. Let us spread the word. If you don't, give us the truth. Give us what you believe is true. And then let us fact check it. Let us go through it and present it to our audience if we believe it's true. Don't make us search for it. Don't make us do all this stuff on our own. If you have it, give it to us and then let us do our own reporting on whether it's accurate or not. You don't just take the word of a government. But it is nice to at least hear their side of the story. That's really important. You got all the spin that's going on the media, on social media. It's important to push back against the lies. And we're getting all the spin now in the media about what we're having today, which is shutdown day, arguably. We'll see if that happens or not. Chris Bedford is going to join us with all the details on that next. There are moments in life when everything depends on preparation. Doesn't depend on panic, doesn't depend on luck, just preparation. And that's where Jace Medical comes in. They offer emergency use antibiotics and prescription meds that you can keep on hand. So if the supply chain collapses, or if your pharmacy is closed, or if you're, you know, traveling overseas and can't get what you need, you're still covered. And you know, you don't need to be trying to find a stocked pharmacy during a crisis. You just need to have the stuff. I had this happen to me when I was on vacation. My son was sick. He needed medication. Nothing was open. I had to drive 90 minutes to get to a 24-hour pharmacy. It was 2:00 in the morning. My son in the car, he was miserable. It was a tough, tough road. Unfortunately, I didn't have my Jace case with me, which embarrassingly, because I talk to you about it all the time. But Jace connects you with licensed professionals who evaluate your needs and prescribe what makes sense before there's an emergency, and they deliver a full supply of antibiotics or daily meds right to your door. They even include a guidebook so you know how and when to use each medication. In a world that can change overnight, you don't want to be the person hoping things go back to normal. You want to be ready. And with Jace Medical, you can be ready all the time. Go to jace.com. Enter the promo code STU at checkout for a discount on your order. The promo code is STU at jace.com. J-A-S-E.com. The promo code is STU.
Kaffee in seiner besten Form mit der neuen Cubo One Kapselmaschine von Tchibo. In jeder Cubo-Kapsel steckt Spitzenkaffee aus besonderen Anbaugebieten. Für Espresso, Kaffeecrema oder Kaffee Grande auf Knopfdruck. Die neue Cubo One überzeugt mit Premium-Design, kompakter Größe und kleinem Einstiegspreis ab 29 Euro. Dank innovativer Press-Brew-Technologie wird jede Tasse besonders aromatisch mit samtiger Crema. Entdecke jetzt die Cubo-Kapselmaschinen in deiner Tchibo-Filiale und auf tchibo.de.
I want to bring in Chris Bedford, Blaze News Senior Editor for Politics and Washington Correspondent for Blaze Media. He has a new piece out on the Blaze today. It's all you know, all you need to know about Shutdown Day. Be sure to check it out. Chris, what do we need to know about Shutdown Day?
Well, this is a battle that's been long coming. There's not a lot of ways out of this one. Republicans hold the cards. Democrats don't hold any cards. And their base wants a fight. They want that more than policy changes. They want that more than anything other than the fact that they want to be in charge again. So they are demanding a fight. I mean, just take, for example, that Chuck Schumer's office had a plan to pitch a 7-day extension to continue negotiations. Now, someone in his office leaked that plan before he pitched it anywhere, probably a progressive staffer, and it was torn to pieces. Chuck Schumer wants to capitulate again. We need no. We need a shutdown. The House of Representatives, which is always the place that wants to shut down most, more than the Senate, whether it's GOP or Democrat, are baying for it. The base demands it. And the good news for the Trump administration is that they will be able to get a whole lot done if the Democrats shut down this government.
It's fascinating. And that really, I mean, you go back, Schumer is such a key to this, right? Because last time he, you know, as the left would say, capitulated, right? He was just like, well, we'll just go along with it. We don't have any power. They can do really bad things to us if we shut it down. He tried that and the left erupted. And Schumer can see AOC right behind him waiting to run for his Senate seat potentially very soon or some other big progressive candidate running against him. He now has really no other choice but to fight. I mean, this is why I feel like this one might be a little different than our previous shutdowns, which always seem to be solved at the last minute.
Yeah, I don't think there's any solving it. I mean, the Democrats went to the White House yesterday, and the plan was to try and work out a deal, but their deal is Republicans put $1 trillion towards undoing Republican legislation, including funding health care for illegal immigrants, for example. They're not going to do that. That's a non-starter. There are certain Democratic asks that might get figured out, like figuring out what to do about Obamacare tax subsidies and helping people pay for premiums. So that's an important chip that Republicans might trade for something later because they don't want to get caught by people saying my healthcare premiums went up. They're stuck in that trap, too, like D.C. always gets stuck in when they try to touch healthcare and mess with it. But they'll trade that for something that they actually want, not for a 1-month clean CR, which is what they're trying to pass right now. And Schumer's chips are so low with the Democratic Party. Politico went around and surveyed in 4 different states where Democrats have a chance in the Senate, either open or contested. And they talked to every candidate, major Senate candidate that they could. And of those who responded, not one was willing to back Schumer, and some of them has openly attacked him. He's not popular to back amongst the Democrats. He doesn't have any wins under his belt, but really, how could he? They don't have a majority in the House, the Senate, and they don't control the White House. So they're going to go to this. And it's going to give people like the White House, Russ Vogt over at the OMB, a whole lot of power to decide what happens. I mean, remember the Obama shutdown? Was it 2013 or so? Where he took out all of his rage on the American people, tried to make it as uncomfortable as possible, shut down national parks, literally took the top. They put more work into shutting this down than they would if they'd actually been in business, taping things off, saying World War II veterans can't visit their memorial, taking literally the handles off of water fountains in the bike trail. They tried to shut down a kid's playground near me and tape it off, which wasn't even theirs. They tried to shut down the George Washington Mount Vernon Estate parking lots, but not even knowing that those are privately owned. They tried to put restaurants out of business. Now, Republicans are going to turn around and say, listen, the government's not funded. So all of you programs that Donald Trump doesn't like and doesn't want, but hasn't gotten the Congress to get rid of, who don't have money, we're not just going to furlough you. We're going to ask for a reduction in personnel. You're going to have to fire people. And then if you ever do actually get funded again, then they can reapply for their jobs. So this is the sort of thing where they're going to target different parts of the bureaucracy and say, you're done here. And the only way you come back is if you get money specifically appropriated to you. And then you can begin firing in a level that's commensurate with what you actually need. That is lasting damage to the American left and to the bureaucracy. Democrats are demanding it. I do not think they know what they're asking for.
It really is interesting because they believed these threats last time. And this was their stated reason why they didn't go through with the shutdown last time. They'd eventually go along with it. They got such a bad reception from the left. Now they're trying to change that up. One of the fascinating parts about this, Chris, is, you know, like, I don't know, you're probably the same way, but like for me, the size of government after a shutdown is much, much closer to my version of government than the current one. Like I the shutdown doesn't seem to affect my life whatsoever. But, you know, it's all about the politics, right? How does this play out? We're going into a year coming up with a big midterm election that's typically been challenging for the presidential party. And I've noticed over the past couple of weeks, we didn't have the 2-week buildup of all the sob stories of the people that would be laid off and how this would be affecting them. Because it seems to me the media is gearing up to blame Republicans for this, even though normally they blame the party that is out of power for a shutdown. So how do the politics play out after this?
It's going to be a lot harder to sell. I mean, normally Republicans are blamed for shutdowns because since the 1980s and 70s, Republicans have launched most shutdowns. And having talked to Republicans who actually achieved shutdown, maybe the day after, I would ask them, well, what's your plan next? And one staffer told me off the record, well, we're kind of the dog that caught the car here. We were hoping that someone was going to break and agree to our demands, and it doesn't seem that's going to happen. So we're going to have to figure out a way back to this. Democrats are relying on media to try and bail them out. But at least in D.C., even their own media is saying this is not a winning fight and it's not looking good for you. Some of their sycophants are saying, but at least they're going to do a bunch of press conferences and maybe that will help pierce through the bubble and they'll be able to get to the American people. But another thing that they don't have right now that they have had in previous shutdowns is they can't really run to CNN or MSNBC or the New York Times and reach more than a couple people. All they're reaching are their true believers. They're not actually reaching out to the middle of America and those people who are open to being convinced and those people like you who aren't really impacted by a shutdown, at least one that's only lasting probably five plus days, which is what we're looking at right now. Social Security checks are going to end up flowing if a little delayed. The administration is going to have to figure out ways to make sure that emergency funds are used for air traffic control and other aspects, because you don't want that for certain to happen. You don't want any kind of air disasters to happen that might be blamed in this shutdown. Try to keep things basically functioning while specifically punishing the bureaucracy and those parts that power the American left. So the politics and the power and the persuasion that they've previously brought to these battles simply don't exist. And at the same time, whoever has the bully pulpit usually wins. Republicans have that completely. And Schumer is not a very good messenger. Hakeem Jeffries is not a great messenger who's able to just penetrate that with some word jujitsu. So this is poor politics, the Democrats as well, but they need to do it or their base is just going to completely lose it.
They are in a tough spot. I mean, I'm glad they're in a tough spot because they're awful. They are in a tough spot. How does this affect this? You write in the piece a little bit about how this might affect Virginia. There's a gubernatorial race and like, you know, the midterms are on our minds, but that's still a ways away. We'll have a million other fires that need to be put out before then. But coming relatively soon is this gubernatorial race in Virginia. Winsome Sears looks like she's, you know, behind and certainly not the favorite in this race. Is there any impact that we might see here?
Yeah, I think there actually could be. Winsome is losing this race right now. It looks like the Democrat is going to win. Spanberger, an absolute DEI, castrate the children, Democrat, literal CIA veteran through and through. Strange person for them to be running, but she's a better politician, has raised more money, and she's the front runner right now. The problem for Virginia Democrats is their trick always to turning Virginia from a battleground state that was conservative leaning to a blue state, essentially, has been the massive expansion of government. So if you end up permanently furloughing or laying off and firing or even just skipping the paychecks for a few weeks on hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of people in the Democratic stronghold of Northern Virginia, based on something that Spanberger voted for and the entire Virginia Democratic delegation voted for, then that's actually a wild card thrown into this race, that if she is able to capitalize it and Republicans are interested in capitalizing on it, would be, it'd make great for great advertising and could potentially disrupt Democrats' plans to have the executive mansion in Virginia.
Fascinating one. All right, last one, and you wrote the book here on it, All You Need to Know on Shutdown Day. I like to dabble in the prediction markets a little bit. I got a position on Kalshi for the first time, I think, in a while of yes. Like, I do think there's going to be a shutdown this time. Previously, you could always kind of be safe just saying no. Eventually, these things always work out. Is my money safe, Chris?
I think it will be worked out, but not before it shuts down.
Okay.
I mean, the safe bet is Democrats shut it down for 5 days. It's going to depend on their tolerance for pain and how far Republicans push it, how far Russ Vogt in the cabinets and the agencies and the programs who he's given directions to actually take this ball and run with it, to see how quickly Democrats end up folding and try to get busy with the lawsuits to just try to undo all of the damage that they've done. So 5 days is a conservative bet right now. Could go as long as 10, 11, 12.
By the way, there's a big profile in the New York Times on Russ Vogt just yesterday, I believe it was. Thousands and thousands of words about how he is essentially the mastermind for all of this. Now, it's funny because sometimes those things don't work out well in Trump world. Like, sometimes I think it's seen as a plea for attention, right? And that's not always the best thing. I don't think that's what Russ is doing here. I think this is kind of outward pressures. Have you heard anything about this? Is this making any waves in Washington?
Well, the danger with getting taking away attention and being a glory hog in the administration generally lies with going on television. That's often what can tick off the president, trying to take credit for things that he's behind. But right now, I mean, Russ Vogt, more than a lot of other people, is anything but a glory hog.
Yeah,
he's someone who is of the bureaucracy, knows the bureaucracy. He fits the part, looks the part, keeps his nose down, doesn't do a lot of publicity, doesn't cooperate with a lot of these sorts of things. And his actions, I think, will protect him pretty well. Of course, if he gets a massive, many thousand word profile and then screws everything up for the president, things can change pretty quickly.
Yes, it can happen quickly. All right, Chris Bedford, senior editor for the news over at Blaze News, politics in Washington, correspondent for Blaze Media as well. Be sure to check out his piece over at The Blaze. It is called All You Need to Know About Shutdown Day. Chris, thanks so much for all your coverage here, and let's see how this all plays out.
It'll be fun, Stu. Thanks for having me.
Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche Cespri Sangold Kiwi. Das Stück für nur 55 Cent. Oder dunkle Tafeltrauben. 500 Gramm für nur 1,79 Euro. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
You're going to be shocked to hear that the Jimmy Kimmel phenomenon is not seemingly a lasting one. I was stunned as well. Jimmy Kimmel did get 6.5 million viewers on that one day when he came back after his the biggest attack against free speech in our nation's history, also known as the four-day paid suspension of Jimmy Kimmel. By the way, I think he only does like 30 weeks a year anyway, so he's off all the time. So it's basically like every other day. But that was the worst thing that's ever happened in our country. He was at 6.5 million. He's now down to 2.3 million. So a massive drop off. He went from 1.7 million in the key demo for advertisers. Down, that's 25, 54 adults, from 1.7 million down to 465,000. Now, 465 is still way higher than he was before all this happened. So I would continue, I would argue you're going to see a continual drop for weeks and weeks after this. And eventually he just returned back to his normal terrible numbers. But 465,000, they might even be able to break even with that number. So I doubt that's going to continue. Now, one way if you're a really hard left-wing crazy person and you want to do a late-night show and you want to actually get ratings, and this is something that Seth Meyers is about to try out, is to not do your own show and instead have Taylor Swift do it. That's one way of getting ratings. Taylor Swift gets a full episode of Late Night with Seth Meyers as part of her Showgirl push. That's the name of her new album. I am very well aware of that because my daughter is extremely excited about it. Will she watch the Seth Meyers episode? No. No, she will not. At least not that I will know of. Mom Donnie is in the news. He is pissed off at Donald Trump. Trump called him a communist, and he's not a communist. You should know that. He is instead a democratic socialist, which is totally different than communism. As we all know, Marx described socialism as the step between capitalism and communism. So you have to get socialism first, then you can do the communism thing after you're already in there. That's the way that's supposed to work. He said, no, I am a, Aaron Burnett asked, are you a communist? He said, no, I am a democratic socialist. I've said that time and time again. Can you say a little louder? You know, for those of us in the back, can you make sure to keep saying it? Now, that probably will help him win in New York. He's winning bigly in the polls right now. A new poll says Mamdani holding a lead over Cuomo in the New York City mayoral race. This is a Marist poll, I believe it is. Marist poll showed Mamdani with 45%, Cuomo with 24%. Eric Adams, who's no longer in the race, had 9%, and Curtis Sliwa had 17%. Now, that 9% from Adams as he drops out, most of that will be distributed among other candidates. Probably Mamdani will get a point or two out of that. The majority of it will likely go to Cuomo, though Sliwa will probably pull a few of those percentage points as well. So if there's only down to two candidates, you're likely to see a close race, but it's hard to see Mamdani. If he's at 45% in a four-way race, it's very, like, when these things break down, you're always like, well, if you take those 9% and you give it to Cuomo, it almost never happens that way. It's usually like maybe 6-3 or 7-2, which, you know, will help Cuomo, but will not be enough to get him over the finish line. So we will see. And finally, one other political development. Paul Feinbaum of ESPN is considering quitting ESPN to run for the Senate in Alabama. He talked to Clay Travis on Outkick the show and gave him news. He's seriously considered leaving his role at ESPN. He's a college football guy, been there for a very long time. And considering running for Senate. Now, he'd probably be a good senator. He seems to be a smart guy, seems to have a good temperament, probably do the job well. I cannot support him, though, I have to admit. I cannot, because I'm looking at the details here. He's only 70. That's way too young for the Senate, okay? You know, Paul, come back to me when you hit triple digits, okay? You come back at 100, 105, then you're seasoned well enough to enter the Senate. 70 years old. I mean, what are we doing here? But if he does step into the race, good luck to Paul Feinbaum. Okay. So here's what happened. I walk into my house the other day. My son is watching TV, which he tends to occasionally do. And on this particular day, I look at the screen and I'm trying to figure out what he's watching. And he seems to be watching a person who is very close to being set on fire. Fire all around him. And then I realize it's a Mr. Beast video. Mr. Beast is defending trapping a man in a burning building for $500,000. Now, look, Mr. Beast is one of the biggest creators out there. He gets lots, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of followers, gets billions of views on these videos overall, hundreds of millions of them on, you know, some of these things. Do you really think this guy was in danger? I mean, honestly, here's a picture of it. Yeah, he's in a building and there's fire there. However, I'm pretty sure they're not going to actually light him on fire. My guess is the video doesn't end with flesh on burning off of bone. It's not how this ends. The guy gets the money, I think. I don't know. But anyway, he did not die. They had all sorts of, it was a stunt. And they had a bunch of fire suppression available and all sorts of experts on site. The guy makes like hundreds of millions of dollars. They're not going to light a guy actually on fire in one of the videos. And certainly if he did do it, the video wouldn't come out. They probably pay him 10 times that to shut up about it. So don't worry, that's not happening. Share the Arrows is a Blaze TV Ali Beth Sucky event. It's coming to Dallas, Texas. Get your tickets at sharetheArrows.com. You're going to love it. SharetheArrows.com.